Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. An idea is the one gift that you can hang on to even after you've given it away. The TED Radio Hour, hosted by Guy Raz, is an hour of new ways to think and create and fresh approaches to old problems. Ready to explore? Dig into the TED Radio Hour podcast. Find it now on iTunes, along with other NPR podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll consider the projects that continue or even begin after an artist is gone. Can you honor a legacy without tarnishing it? And if you can, should you? Then we'll revisit a favorite recurring segment and name some of the people we're pulling for as they go about their various endeavors. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And you make up terribly difficult quizzes about Batman.
Yep.
For
yep.
Anyone who didn't hear it, I encourage you to listen to the
quizzes that divide the listenership.
Listen to the Batman quiz. Listen to the great Audie Cornish, who we thank once again for being with us last week. Although we are also always happy to have our pal Gene Demby in the room with
us. Thank you for having me. It's so much fun.
Oh, it's wonderful to see you, bud. We started talking about this topic for a few reasons, one of which was the Michael Jackson album Xscape. It pains me to say, which is scheduled for release on May 9th, but last Friday also brought the arrival of Brick Mansions, one of the last films that Paul Walker did before he died. There's a new film out starring Michael Clark Duncan, and there are still a couple left in the Philip Seymour Hoffman catalog as well. So when this first came up, one of the suggested names for the segment was Posthumous We, which I think reflects a certain wariness and weariness that a lot of us have about these kinds of projects. Glenn, that might have been something you said.
Yep.
That sounds like a Glenn Weldon.
And I'm wondering, is there a particular project, a particular kind of project that makes you weary/wary, or is it just the whole darn thing?
No, my mind went straight to books, actually. Because you saw the Paul Walker film, right? And I understand that in the Paul Walker film, there's a couple scenes where his car crashes. That must have been gross.
It's weird because I did see this referred to briefly, I think, in our pal Chris Klimek's review of this movie. Chris and I saw Brick Mansions together, as we do with this kind of movie very frequently. And Chris had pointed out, look, you know, the guy made car crash movies.
Yeah.
He was good at, and I don't mean that in the kind of damning with faint praise way that it sounds, but you know, he was a very agreeable action star in a bunch of movies about fast cars. And I enjoyed watching him in those movies. And if you cut those out, it's like you're trying to make Brick Mansions elegiac, which it's not, and it's not going to be.
Well, yeah, and you don't automatically strike from the record every piece of entertainment in which Steve Irwin interacts with animals.
Sure.
Right, of course.
You know, that's what he did. That's what he died doing.
Right, absolutely. So when you say books, talk to me about that.
Well, I mean, this posthumous thing is tricky because Franz Kafka burned, reportedly, an estimated 90% of everything he ever wrote, because he just was never happy with anything. And when he died, he asked his friend, his dear friend, Max Brod, one thing. He said, "Everything I leave behind is to be burned unread." And Max Brod said, "Yep, sure, gotcha, see ya," and proceeded to publish everything, which is how we get The Castle, The Trial, America, and pretty much every one of his stories. He didn't publish very much during his life, and so a lot of what we know about Franz Kafka now because of that. Also, similarly, Vladimir Nabokov, his last novel, The Original of Laura, he asked his son to destroy it because it was unfinished. Son said, sure, published it. Now, it's different because Nabokov, everybody knew him, nobody knew Kafka. When The Original of Laura was published posthumously, it was hugely controversial. It was seen as tainting his legend. And to me, though, this is kind of what I want to talk about. I mean, yes, it's an invasion. Yes, it's something you shouldn't do. It's also really useful. I mean, to see Nabokov, who was such a prose stylist, to see him, it was by no means a first draft, but when I read it, I saw the connective tissue. in a way that I've never seen anything like that in Nabokov before.
Right.
So I think you don't have to say, was it an invasion, was it a boon? It's both. You can kind of have it occupy two simultaneous parts of your brain. Finally, The Pale King by David Foster Wallace. When he committed suicide, his editor went to his house, took a bunch of manuscripts together, went into his computer and gleaned from his files and kind of stitched The Pale King together. I don't know why going into somebody's computer feels like such a worse thing.
Well, because you don't want somebody going into your computer.
That's exactly right.
Stay away from my browser history.
Yeah.
Historians.
Okay, and I'll just pick one more thing. So E.M. Forster's Maurice, written in 1913, about two gay dudes who end up together happy. When he wrote it, he knew he could write about gay dudes. He couldn't write about gay dudes being happy. They had to come to some terrible end. So after he died, the manuscript was found, and there was a note that he wrote to himself in the margin saying, publishable, but worth it? ? Mm-hmm. So it was not written in 1913, didn't get published until 1971.
Interesting. You know, Gina and I were talking about this a little bit today, about kind of this issue of like editing yourself and deciding which of your projects to pursue and not to pursue is part of your creative impulse. And so for me, it's very difficult to accept the idea of going into somebody's unfinished stuff and saying, oh, I'm just going to do the best I can to stitch it together, because perhaps there's a good reason why they hadn't published it yet. Perhaps they thought it wasn't ready. And I have kind of issues with saying I take it upon myself to decide that your thing is going to get published anyway.
Absolutely. And so the point you made that was really good was that for someone who dies and their work is posthumously released, a lot of those people have people who are dependent on them, like monetarily. And so you have Tupac's situation, right? Where like after he dies, there are like maybe like a half dozen albums of increasingly bad quality because they're all just kind of like rough drafts of stuff.
We found some of his answering machine tapes.
Absolutely. And there was, you know, there was a fight between his family and, you know, his mother wanted control of some of the masters. But it was like stuff that wasn't good. It wasn't supposed to be released. But there's obviously a profit motive there. I mean, people need to eat, right? And Pac is the way they're going to eat.
Well, Tupac is a great example of this. And music is where my head immediately went on this, because you have so many examples. First of all, you have a lot of examples of musicians dying young for various musicianly reasons. In the case of Tupac, like many others, he was more prolific in death than he was in life. Yeah. See also Jeff Buckley. See also Jimi Hendrix. Right before I was running into the studio, I got word from the All Songs Considered folk that there is a quote-unquote new Roy Orbison song where Roy Orbison sang into a boombox some otherwise unrecorded song that has been now turned into a quote-unquote new Roy Orbison song. Roy Orbison died in 1988. To be following music right now is to receive constant word of reunions. Everything in music is getting back together. Lars Gotrich was blogging for All Songs Considered and was writing about a band that he loved that had gotten back together, and all of a sudden, and he was like, boy, you know, short of this band getting back together, this would be the greatest thing. And they got back together 2 days later. Every single band is getting back together. And this afternoon, I was like, even Roy Orbison is reunited.
Yeah, I mean, this actually, very frequently when we're talking about a topic like this, I do a little Googling just to, you know, not to find my comments, but to jog my brain a little bit.
Right.
And one of the things that I came across was a list in the Village Voice called the 10 most exploitative posthumous rap projects, which has a couple of Biggie Smalls records. J. Dilla, who they argue is more famous in death than alive, and Tupac. The phrase that they used, they wrote sort of acidically of the, quote, nonstop, free-flowing nature of his post-death gravy train. Yeah. So it is something that a lot of people talk about, the fact that it's in poor taste. And it does seem like there's a difference between, is it a finished project? Because like things like Brick Mansions or whatever, most movies that come out after people die. I think there was a little bit of talk around Mockingjay after Philip Seymour Hoffman had died, that they were going to try to complete it with kind of the use of maybe some CGI and some trickery. And there's some talk about whether that was cool or not. But most of the time with movies, you're talking about things that were completed. They were shot there in production. There's a difference between that, it seems to me, and essentially raiding somebody's unfinished work and making a choice that they didn't make while they were alive.
You bring up an interesting point. You mentioned J. Dilla. With J. Dilla, a lot of the posthumous work, and yes, there are definitely some cheap cash-in-y Jay Dilla tribute projects. But Jay Dilla is also somebody that a lot of people in hip-hop want more people to know about and want more. Like, creating the legend of Jay Dilla is not just a matter of a gravy train, but it's also like, and you know, this is true a little bit with Jeff Buckley as well, somebody who died early enough in life and with little enough output that there's this desire to pump up the person's legend because you love the work so much.
Right. I think there's some of that with Jason Molina, don't you think?
Oh, God, yeah, already. I mean, Jason...
I mean, there's a sense that, like, people just want to kind of amplify the work that exists, which is a different thing from taking a bunch of things that the person didn't necessarily decide were ready.
Yeah, I mean, at least so far, the Jason Molina tribute projects that have come out, you either have people covering his songs or you're doing deluxe reissues in the hopes that the people who've been hearing about him since he died last year get into him. And the fact of the matter is, you know, with somebody like Molina, it's a difference between the family of Jimi Hendrix arguing over millions of dollars worth of master recordings and the family of Jason Molina, who are still trying to pay his funeral expenses.
Right. And maybe that kind of gets into the thing that Gina and I were talking about with families and the need to kind of, if somebody has been living on the proceeds of, for example, Michael Jackson records and Tupac records and whatever, the difference between that and maybe somebody who never made a tremendous amount of money like Jason Molina, where nobody's used to living off your money.
Right.
So there's not that kind of very rational, maybe regrettable, but very rational thing that, like, essentially your work is the family business.
That was the story during his lifetime, that his family had this kind of parasitic relationship toward him, right? I mean, they, like...
Since he was a little kid.
Absolutely, right. So it sort of makes sense that even in death, that's still sort of the story around him, that there are all these people around him who need to cash in one last time. To your Dilla point, though, I mean, I love Jay Dilla a lot. I mean, but... And I didn't know until he died that he'd worked on, like, all these albums that were, like, of great import to me when I was growing up. De La Soul's Stakes Is High album, and I think Mama's Gun is like one of my three or four favorite albums, and he produced most of Erykah Badu's Mama's Gun, and you know, the people he worked with, like Questlove, those people all have, like, tremendous amount of, like, credibility. And so, you know, they're shouting him out all the time.
Right.
Like, there were a lot of people, myself included, and I liked his music that he headlined on Slum Village's stuff and his own projects when he was alive. And once he died, I think, there was, like, a real, to your point, there was, like, a real kind of legend building around him.
Yeah.
I mean, now people just name check him all the time.
Yeah. It's gotten more plentiful, and it's been, what, almost 10 years?
Yeah, probably more, yeah.
Wow.
Right. Let me ask you guys a question. You guys went to music, and I went to books because I think I'm more a book guy than a music guy. But also, I have convinced myself that writing is the most unmediated way of kind of engaging with an art. It seems to me that music has so many people between you and the artist. Mm-hmm. I understand there's publishers.
Maybe
editors.
Maybe painting.
Sure.
I know what you mean.
There's a direct connection, and if it's a long novel, it's a sustained connection.
Right.
I have said on this show many times that, you know, I don't care about the artist. The artist is dead. What matters is the work. It occurred to me today, thinking about this, that I'm kind of a hypocrite because there's one guy, a writer named Donald Bartlemy, who wrote a lot of short stories, who was the writer who made me want to be a writer. And so it seems to me that when a writer that you love is living, it feels like you're in a conversation with that writer. It feels like, in the back of your mind as you're reading, you realize that this guy's going to get feedback. There's a critical community around him. There's an artistic community around him. He's part of this conversation, even if I'm just absorbing this work.
Right.
The connection I feel to this work is different. He died in 1989. They came out with his posthumous book, The King, in 1990. I didn't want to read it for a while because, A, I thought, you know, I don't want this to be the last thing I ever read of him. It turned out not to be the case because, again, it's like they just keep putting out new short stories, uncollected short stories. But also, when I did read it, I didn't feel that electric charge. Now, I don't want to say, like, get as grandiloquent as he belongs to the ages now, but there was something missing. There was definitely something missing. He felt like a dead author. He felt like there wasn't this connection. So do you guys feel that way with music? Is there anything like the charge that goes missing?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially when something comes out that busts out of the chronology. For example, if just a few weeks, maybe a couple months ago, there was a quote-unquote new Johnny Cash record. It was a finished album from 1983 when music never sounded better. and they released it. It's called Out Among the Stars, and it sounds like an early 80s when Johnny Cash was not at his peak creatively, to say the least. It's fine, that record. But you're taking it, it is a museum piece. It's a curiosity. As a big Johnny Cash fan, listening to all his records late in life, part of what you're experiencing is this ravaging aging process on his voice, where his voice is just breaking down and down and down and down, where it still sounds like him. You're hearing somebody who is still, he's struggling to get out his last expressions. And it's very beautiful, and it's very dark, and can be very maudlin. And when you suddenly, it's like, oh, there's a new Johnny Cash record. And it takes you suddenly back to when he's, a middle-aged man.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little, I guess I'd rather this exist than not exist. I guess I'd rather have the choice to have this rather than to not have this.
Uh-huh.
There's this degradation that happens where you're like, well, we're going to keep getting these posthumous things. You know, with somebody like Johnny Cash, there was so much work to begin with. Like, when Bob Dylan dies, we're going to get like 50 years of like, oh, it's the 17th alternate take of, this song.
Right. And I think there might be a difference between, there are certain tribute projects and in fact, even alternate takes and stuff like that, that have independent value. Because there are even musicians who release, alternate takes when they're alive. Like, that is a thing that theoretically has value if you decide that you think it's interesting. I have a couple of Elvis Costello records that he released through Rhino with a bunch of alternate takes, and they're actually super fascinating.
Yeah.
If you are interested in songwriting, seeing what an early version of this song sounded like and how it changed and which elements were originally there and which elements it was originally conceived without. And I think the same is true of tribute records. When you talk about the tribute with people covering Jason Molina and things like that, those are very different to me than the things that just seem like these finding more stuff, any stuff, because you can't stop putting out stuff. You know, you wind up with people just kind of going with their gut in terms of, which do you think it is? Like, do you think this is really people saying, look, he worked very hard to finish this stuff. He didn't get to finish it. He didn't get to get it out there before he died. He desperately wanted to get it out there, and worked very hard. And I know, for example, that I think David Rakoff worked very hard to get his final book, which was released after he died, the one that's written in verse, I think worked very hard to get that finished while he was ill. So it makes a lot of sense that you would go ahead and everybody would sort of put their shoulder into making sure that that book got done and got done as well as possible. And there are writers, I'm not going to lie, he's actually one of them, but there are writers where if you suddenly told me, there's a notebook of stuff, it would be very hard for me.
Sure.
Like, if you said, Roger Ebert was working on a book of essays about television and he just never got around. And he didn't necessarily think they were done, but there's
sketches.
But they're just stuff he was working on. I'd be like, oh my God, I really want to see that just because I'm interested in it. But at the same time, you have that weird feeling of I should respect this person's sense of what was finished and what was not. And that's a very difficult thing when you feel like, well, there's no point now, they're not going to mind,
right?
so there's no point, but there is part of me that just recoils at this idea of if the person didn't think it was done and ready and publishable and the right thing to put out next, and therefore it was in a drawer.
Oh,
you got to respect the drawer. You know what I mean?
Do you ultimately respect the drawer, though? Because some people are so persnickety about this stuff. I mean, was it James Thurber who spent 30 days moving a comma, before he deemed his work complete? There comes a point at which, do you strip something from the personal record because of the capriciousness of the person who made it?
So you're saying that if you're hit by a meteor, it's okay to
release my browser history.
Go into your computer and release your browser history. That's your point.
But think of the things that we wouldn't have if we went by that rule, where you had to be alive for a thing to get published. Northanger Abbey, Persuasion, John Kennedy Toole's Confederacy of Dunces, that was finished. He thought it was finished. Jonathan Larson's Rent was actually in rehearsal. It was only a couple days away. Long Day's Journey into Night after O'Neill died. Three of Ian Fleming's Bond books were published after
Yeah, but you're only talking partly about the drawer. I'm talking about the drawer. You're talking about things that the person had already voluntarily moved out of the drawer and into the world.
Dickens,
I'm talking about invading the drawer.
Dickens' Edwin Drood was not finished, and they published it anyway. That was in the drawer.
I have mixed feelings. I feel like I would want people to respect the drawer.
No, mm-hmm. I agree too.
Yes, this is my way of saying do not go into our content management system. If I am hit by a meteor, do not go into the content management system and publish all the things in there that I started writing and didn't finish.
Remember when occasionally somebody would write in and be like, we really want like a blooper show, yeah. like an outtakes episode of Pop Culture Happy. It's like everything that's been taken out was taken out for a reason. Often it's just me swearing.
You wouldn't like it that much.
Speaking of, I think it's actually pronounced Morris, not Maurice, mm-hmm. the Emer Forster novel. So just don't write in. We got it. We got it. I made a mistake. Morris. Doesn't make any sense. Not spelled Morris, spelled Maurice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is America, but sure, fine, whatever. Morris.
At any rate, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us what you think about this kind of work and what your favorite posthumous works are and whether there's any validity to my scream to the heavens to respect the drawer. So the other thing we were going to talk about this week is a little bit more chipper, I would say. It's a little more upbeat. And if you listen to the show, you've heard this segment before. We call it People We're Pulling For. You know, we've interpreted this in a variety of ways. Sometimes it's famous people who we just want to keep being famous. Sometimes it's lower profile people. So I'm always interested to see what direction people decide to go in when we bring these to the table. Stephen Thompson, someone you are pulling for.
Well, as you know, Linda, I have certain shows that I watch as comfort food on television. The Simpsons, Futurama, Archer. And I realized this weekend that all of them, at some point, have featured George Takei.
Sure.
And I started to look over George Takei's filmography, which is voluminous.
Really?
The man does not say no. Very much. He's been on The Celebrity Apprentice. Yeah. He's been on The Newlywed Game. He's popped up on he was on King of the Nerds.
Yes,
another thing that I've watched as comfort food. And I realized, first of all, I just always find him delightful. Even if he's on something stupid, like The Celebrity Apprentice, he manages to bring dignity to The Celebrity Apprentice. And I just
That's just wrong.
And I just find him utterly charming and utterly engaging and funny. And where I'm pulling for him, in addition to just, I like the guy, is I would love to see him cast at some point in a real, actual dramatic role. Mm-hmm. Because he's a guy who has such a sense of humor about himself and is so often spoofing himself, but who has this real, like if you look at his personal history, he has endured a great many very serious things and is a very serious person about a lot of things and has that, you know, he has that wonderful voice. He does tons and tons and tons and tons of voice acting. But I would love to see him in a very serious dramatic role. Since he does everything and anything, cast him in something where he gets to show that he's a good actor.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Have you noticed a disconnect between his presence on something like Stern, when he goes on Stern,
right,
and his Twitter presence? He seems a lot funnier on Twitter. Suspiciously funny.
You're suggesting
nothing. I don't know what you're talking about.
So wags, pundits, if you will, have suggested that he has writers.
I don't know if wags are pundits. I think that's a disconnect.
Anyway, I like him. Sure. He should have a staff. He should have a staff of people making him as funny as he wants to be.
Rosemary and Maury Amsterdam just feeding him lines. Sure.
That was a joke for our parents.
Marie and Maury Amsterdam. All right. Thank you, Stephen. I like your choice, even though Glenn ran him down.
I didn't. There was no running down.
Ran down the beloved George Takei.
I feel comfortable with my place in history being pro George Takei.
Yeah, I am too.
It's a very controversial view.
He's a very funny man. Funny with an asterisk.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Gene Demby. Who are you pulling for?
I think I'm rooting for all the tertiary characters on Mad Men, or the actors and actresses who play them.
Oh, nice. Good call.
I loved that conversation between Shirley, who I don't think we've ever seen before, and Dawn last week.
You want those flowers so bad, you'll take the trouble that comes with getting them back.
It's not right.
Well, I have two bosses, and one of them hasn't told his wife he's on leave. Keep pretending. That's your job.
You know who I feel the worst for is Charles.
He'd rather you have a job.
You know that's not true.
Happy Valentine's, Dawn.
Goodbye, Shirley.
that was hilarious and funny. And I was like, oh my God, two black people are Mad Men and they're talking to each other.
Is that the Blachtel test?
Yeah, exactly. The Blachtel test. Exactly. Right. But then there's, you know, the young actress who plays Don Draper's daughter. She's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Karen Shipka.
Yeah. She's, I mean, she's just, if you watch her reacting to other people, you're always like, she is freakishly good. I mean, you can't really root for Bobby because there's a different actor in that role. But the characters who kind of like are orbiting the satellites of
Rich Sommer. I love Rich Sommer. Rich Sommer. Harry Crane.
Harry is like,
he's kind of a terrible dude, but I love the performance because it's so kind of weirdly clueless on purpose. Mm-hmm. Like, it's got that clumsy.
He seems like a plausible person, too.
He does.
You know, he seems like, like someone you might know.
He does.
Yeah, so I'm just rooting for all of them. I love Tiana Paris. Her hair is awesome all the time in real life. That's it.
Tertiary characters on Mad Men. Yeah. I like it. Especially Dawn and Shirley.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who doesn't love Dawn and Shirley? That would just be wrong. Yeah. All right, Glenn Weldon, who are you pulling for?
All right. Sam Lipsight is a writer of novels and short stories. I first came across him in his, I think it was a 2000 novel called Homeland, and it's basically an epistolary novel. It's all letters that this guy writes to his high school alumni newsletter 20 years after he graduates from high school. It begins like this. It's confession time, Cantamounts. It's time you knew the cold, soft facts of me. Ever since Principal Fontana found me and commenced to bless my mail slot monthly with the Eastern Valley High School alumni newsletter, I've been meaning to write my update. Sad to say, vanity slowed my hand. Let a fever for the truth speed it now. Let me stand on the rooftop of my reckoning and shout naught but the indisputable, I did not pan out. He is so good. He is so good. He's got three. He doesn't need me to pull for him. He's doing fine. He's got three novels, The Subject, Steve, Homeland, and The Ask, which was just published recently. And The Fun Parts is his collection of short stories published last year and his first collection, Venus Drive. He has won a Guggenheim. He's got a short story in The New Yorker this week. He's doing fine. But I worry for him because he practices a very blistering, lacerating, acidic wit that in this culture of the book club, I'm not slamming book clubs, I'm kind of slamming book clubs, where books now come with discussion questions at the end, and so many of these conversations sort of devolve into, I didn't care what happened to this guy. This guy was awful. So much of that, you know, he's often compared to George Saunders. I happen to read George Saunders' 10th of December right before I read The Fun Parts by Sam Lipsight. And I noticed that these are two guys kind of occupying some of the same emotional real estate. There's a lot of crossover there. George Saunders, as dark as he gets, and he gets pretty dark, always has this sort of light of humanity that kind of sneaks in at the end. And I'm not suggesting he's doing that intentionally or cynically to try to anything like that. I think this is actually his worldview. Sam Lipsight has none of that. Sam Lipsight is doing something that I think is riskier. As such, it doesn't pay off sometimes, but it's fascinating. And just this idea that fiction has to be pleasant, that fiction has to reassure us, I worry for him. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying he should be a hell of a lot more famous than he is. He should be on everybody's lips. He is so funny. It's not a pleasant day to sip a Chardonnay with and to talk about how much you love this character. You don't come away from these books with a feeling of, ha. You kind of come away with, ugh.
Yeah, well, you know, normally while we're taping here, we try to keep our attention tightly focused on the conversation that we're having.
Yeah.
With that said, because I talked about a very angry epistolary novel last week on the show that I had really enjoyed, I bought your angry epistolary novel that you were just talking about while you were talking on my Kindle.
There you go.
Bought it on my Kindle while you were talking. So promotion in real life, it really works. So this is a difficult thing because very often the people that I would be pulling for are the people whose projects and work I love talking about on this show. And so as I started to look through, I was like, well, I could say that person, but I've talked about their stuff and why I like it. So I decided that the only solution was to go with something that I had seen very, very recently. Today, I went with our pal Bob Mondello to a screening of the movie Locke, which stars Tom Hardy. It stars Tom Hardy and only Tom Hardy. And what happens in this movie is basically you watch a dude in a car talking on his Bluetooth, and that is the movie. And he is driving in the dark going from one place to another. He has a lot going on in his life, and he's having this series of phone calls, and that's the movie. Okay. And it sounds like the worst thing ever. And it is so, it is such a good movie. It is such a good and strong movie. And the reason Bob and I both went, and Bob and I both really thought it was excellent, is that it had been getting these great reviews. So Locke comes from, it's written and directed by Stephen Knight, who also did Eastern Promises and Dirty Pretty Things. Okay. The movie is so, in a way, audacious because it puts you in this one spot and nothing. You realize, I didn't know this about the movie going in. So you have this moment where you think, oh, this is the movie. It's challenging. It's a challenging moment where you're like, so I'm going to watch this whole movie and this is the movie. And the reason why I chose Tom Hardy is that Tom Hardy is a very good looking dude, right? Very good looking. Well,
that's as good a reason as any. So no.
He's a very good-looking dude. You may know him as Bane in a little movie called The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, he looked great in that movie.
Yeah. I was going to ask if all these phone conversations were in the Bane.
In the Bane mask. but he also did kind of the romantic comedy thing with Reese Witherspoon in that This Is War, This Means War, whatever it's called. And he's done a lot of what I would refer to as young guy British acting. Mm-hmm. But the minute that he comes over and he does The Dark Knight and he does this Reese Witherspoon movie, you start to think, like, is he going to get sucked into being that guy? And the thing that's remarkable about watching him in Locke is that it's kind of his anti, like, don't think of me as a cute, hot actor.
Right. So he doesn't spill coffee on himself and have to take his shirt off at any point.
He is wearing a button-up shirt. He has a beard that is not, I don't think, meant to be a particularly sexy kind of beard. Mm-hmm. And that is the entire movie. It very carefully removes the physical body from the movie, I think, clearly on purpose. It is a face movie. It is all about face acting. And when I watched this, I thought, boy, this guy is a really freaking good actor and a guy who you really worry about, kind of, he's so charismatic and good looking that you really worry about him tipping over into this, like, don't go have a career of dumb things.
Right.
It took Matthew McConaughey so long to get out of that after he started doing it. Don't tip over into something that's not as good as you are. Because in this movie, he's really wonderful.
Yeah. He stole focus away from Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception.
Yes,
certainly.
He's in
Inception, really,
too.
Really did. Mm-hmm. He became the thing that everybody kind of looked at.
Yeah, well, and it's, but that's what I'm saying, is like, he is a really good actor.
Yep.
And when you see this movie, it is so completely his movie. He is literally the only person that you see in the movie. Everybody else's voices.
He's not, that was my question.
Yeah.
Is he acting against
everybody else's
voice
voices, because he's on his speaker in his car. So you're hearing the conversations, but everybody else's voice, it's all his movie. So I realize that saying that you are pulling for Tom Hardy sounds odd, because he's fine.
Well, you're pulling for an outcome.
But I'm pulling for an outcome, which is I want the best and highest use of Tom Hardy, which I think would not be to go down the road that he briefly seemed to be going down. Now, this is a really challenging and serious movie, so clearly he's making an effort in this area. I just want him to continue to make things that are challenging and interesting and not take the path of least resistance, because it's very easy to take the path of least resistance. There's a reason why they call it that.
Well, let's put him in a serious, dramatic role, acting alongside George Takei.
Yes.
And the tertiary characters on Mad Men.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It
written
good.
The screenplay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sam upside play.
So I am pulling for him. And we hope, again, you know, this would be a great one for you to come and find us on social media, find us on the blog, tell us who you're pulling for. We can come up with an entire, like, you know, secular prayer circle in which we will all just put our happy hopes together for the people that who we are deeply pulling for. And of course, this does not change the fact we are also pulling for all the people we're always pulling for. But we chose not to repeat ourselves. But that does bring us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
So I have this like little list of things, and I realized that there's like something for me, there's something for Glenn, there's something for Trey Graham. I've got my NFL draft. Glenn has the comeback.
Yes,
is coming back with Lisa Kudrow on HBO for a 6-episode return engagement. There's a new Dolly Parton album for Trey Graham. So I won't go into my love of the NFL draft. I've mentioned it far too many times. Oh, they're also, it looks like they're renewing King of the Nerds. They're casting it at least, so they're at least. It looks like we're going to get our season 3, Glenn. But I really wanted to mention and call people's attention to an album that we're streaming at NPR Music right now. I know that Linda is a really big fan of this guy, Kishibashi. Who had a wonderful song a couple years ago called Bright Whites that kind of reached a little enough of a critical mass that you were hearing it on commercials and everything. And I remember hearing that song for the first time and thinking, this guy's a huge star. He's going to be a huge star. And he's got a new album out. It's called Light, L-I-G-H-G-H-T. It's this wonderful product of the brain of Kei Ishibashi, who records as Kishibashi. And his brain always sounds like it is both hard at work and always at play. And so his music has this joyful, buoyant, you know, sound to it that's very, very, very playful. Let's hear a little bit of the song Philosophize in It, Chemicalize with It. Okay, so that's Kishibashi from his new album, Light. If you are not familiar with this stuff, first of all, if you have not heard his song, Bright Whites, you can find it all over our website because we only promoted it like 15 times. Mm-hmm. But Kishibashi.
Wonderful. I'm in favor of that, Stephen Thompson. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
I went down the rabbit hole of this book called The History of White People by Nell Irvin Painter. Mm-hmm. She's a historian. I think she's retired now, but I think she used to be at one of the Ivies. But this book is like a synthesizing of like art history and political science and anthropology and pseudoscience. And it explains kind of how we got the racial categories that we now have flattened into this idea of just, we just call it white now. And it's really brisk. I mean, it's like a really brisk read, but it's also like one of those books that I can't stop referencing in conversation. You know, when you're in college, you read that book that like blows your mind. And I feel like I've been referencing it all the time among my code switch team. It's like, actually, it's much more complicated than that, you know.
As I was recently reading in my book.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a fascinating book. I mean, it's one of those books it's about 2 or 3 years old, but it's one of those books I wish I would have read when it was first being reviewed. She kind of walks you through the history of how all these very disparate groups, the many tribes that made up what is now Germany and the many tribes that made up what is now England, started being flattened into things called Saxons and Gauls and then Nordics and Aryans and finally just white people. And it's just really, really, like, it reminds you that, like, this stuff is all completely made up, but also is of like incredible consequence and resonance.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a wonderful book, and I will wait patiently for you to continually reference it all the time.
Yeah.
All right. Say the title and the author again.
It's The History of White People by Nell Irvin Painter.
Wonderful. Mm. All about me. Thank you, Jason. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Tomorrow, as you listen to this, if you listen to this on Friday, is once again Free Comic Book Day in comic book stores across this land of ours. May 3rd, Free Comic Book Day. You can walk into a comic book store as long as you find one that's participating. You do that by going to freecomicbookday.com and using the store locator, and they will hand you some free comic books. What's better than that? It's always awesome. This year, as I have 5 times in a row now, I have reviewed the Free Comic Book Day books that are available. I have a guide on the NPR Monkey See site. This year, there were more books than usual. There are 57 comics. And, you know, so I kind of feel like when Stephen Thompson does the South by Southwest 100, there's like 5,000 words here, people. Read it, please. Please read it. I did make some recommendations, but, you know, and you should understand that some stores are going to have all these books. Some stores are going to only have a few. Some you'll be able to pick the ones you want. Some they'll hand you some. It's free comics. That's the bottom line here. Just enjoy it. I will ask you, though, if you go to a store, buy something. Buy something. It doesn't have to be one. Just, you know, you're there to participate, ask them questions. They are trained to say, if you like this book, this TV show, this movie, they have something that they can recommend to you. So please do that. But because, for a special bonus for the listeners, you don't have to read it. I'll list my 10 top free comic books here right now.
Wonderful.
This will change tomorrow.
Wonderful.
It'll change the day after that. But right now, so all of these are listed. All these are recommended. There's a lot more recommendations on the blog. But for right now, you want to look for Kaboom Summer Blast, Avatar, The Last Airbender, Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck, The Top Shelf Kids Club, Atomic Robo. This is the lesson. Every year, always pick up Atomic Robo. It's great. Every year they offer it in Free Comic Book Day. Every year it's great. Rise of the Magi, Courtney Crumrin, Project Black Sky, which features psychic cyborg gorillas in Vegas. So, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Hip Hop Family Tree by Ed Piskor, which is two excerpts from a fascinating, wonderful history of hip hop, comic book history of hip hop and rap, that is just so infused with love of the music and love of comics. It is so good. I dare you to pick this up, look at a couple panels, and not want to get the entire two-volume history. It's fascinating. And also Raising a Reader, which is put out by the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. It's a little handy handbook for how to get kids understanding how to read comics, also how to use comics in education. It's a really fascinating little handbook for kids, so Raising a Reader. So that's all 10. They're all on the website. There's a lot more there. Please read it. Please comment and go to Free Comic Book Day.
Wonderful. Awesome. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. So I have two things that are making me happy this week. One of them is a book that I have been reading. The book is called Tales from Development Hell. It's by a guy named David Hughes. And it's about development hell refers to the development of movies and refers to the really clearly miserable process of getting a movie from the stage where everybody says, hey, let's make a movie, to the part where you actually get to shoot it. It's not really focusing on the shooting part. It's focusing on the part where they're trying to decide whether they're even really going to make it, because they buy so many more projects and start so many more projects than ever get made. And you would think that there would be certain projects where once this group of people is involved, this group of powerful people were involved, it couldn't fall apart. And that's so untrue. There is an entire chapter about a movie about the Crusades that Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to do that was very, everybody was talking about it. And then 9/11 happened and it got a little tougher to tell a story about the Crusades. Yeah. And they decided maybe not so much, even though they felt like their story was still a good story. There is a chapter about the long, weird, ultimately terrible experience of trying to get a movie made of Sandman by Neil Gaiman. It is the kind of thing where if you put this book together with some of the books by people like Linda Obst, who I talked about a few weeks ago, if you start to put some of these books together, you start to understand why, despite the fact that people would love to be making good movies, they make so many bad movies, and how things happen. Like, if you get brought in to help improve a script, you have to change a bunch of stuff, even if it's already good, because otherwise you will not get paid and you will not get your screenwriting credit and your royalties. So you have to change it, even if it's not broken, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It is a book that I definitely recommend. Again, Tales from Development Hell. The other is the very delightful, we love our friends at Ask Me Another here at Pop Culture Happy Hour. We love our friends at Ask Me Another. And they had on their show Bobby and Kristen Lopez, who are the songwriting team that did the songs in Frozen. And he worked on Avenue Q, and they're just, they are the kind of people who make you think about those like Hollywood dinner parties that you envision from like the 40s with people gathering around the piano and then someone plays something and someone sings. They are so charming and likable, and they clearly like each other so much. They had very nice chemistry with the show. Near the end of that show, Ask Me Another, this happened.
Got the horse right here, name is Paul Revere, and there's a guy that says if the weather's clear.
I'm picking Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy's got him figured out 5 to 9.
But look at him and says the horse, he wears a tie, I have, according to this here's his telegraph.
Paul Revere says the horse, here's what's alright, as it all depends if it rained last night.
So that song is called Fugue for Tin Horns, and it was written by Frank Lesser. It comes at the beginning beginning of the musical Guys and Dolls. And it is typically performed in the show by the three sort of gamblers who work with one of the main characters in that movie, Nathan Detroit. And Fugue for Tin Horns is, you know, if you went back and thought about what are the great Broadway numbers for three people, that's one of them. Mm-hmm. And I would have had trouble coming up with that. But yeah. They are people who love, you know, show music. Jonathan Colton is someone who can do anything. That's who that is. That's Jonathan Colton and Kristen and Bobby Lopez. And they were so great, and he is so flexible and does so many different things that all of a sudden in the middle of this thing, this is just their little kicker from one segment to another. And they made it just for me because I love that show so much. And it sent me, of course, down the delightful rabbit hole of listening to Guys and Dolls a lot. As I said on Twitter today, I missed my calling in life because I never got to play Miss Adelaide from Guys and Dolls. And when NPR does its radio theater version of Guys and Dolls, I will make them let me play Miss Adelaide. And Ari Shapiro will play Sky Masterson. That's what I've decided. I'm casting it in my head. There's a part for Carl Castle. If you know the show, you know the one I'm talking about. And I'm working on it. I'm casting it in my head. It's happening. We're getting there. So that's what's making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Gene at GED215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's REEDY. And our also producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick, like Nick. Fountain, like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. An idea is the one gift that you can hang on to even after you've given it away. The TED Radio Hour, hosted by Guy Raz, is an hour of new ways to think and create and fresh approaches to old problems. Ready to explore? Dig into the TED Radio Hour podcast. Find it now on iTunes, along with other NPR podcasts.